Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is The Nitty Gritty. My name is Chad, and what follows is a compilation episode exclusively for our podcast listeners. These are three of our most recent random match reviews. You can find the videos of these on YouTube. What follows are Hulk Hogan versus William Regal, WCW Snow Brawl, and Rick Martel versus Jumbo Tsaruta in AWA. Enjoy.
How's it going, everybody? This is The Nitty Gritty. My name is Chad. With me is Leonard. And this week, we are going to be giving you a new edition of Segment Surgery. Basically, what this is instead of a match where we review it, this is a segment or a promo, something that's not just wrestling related or in-ring technical wrestling related. And we review it and go over it and talk about it. And this week, we are going to be covering something very interesting that probably not a lot of people remember. And it inspired me because I was listening to some episodes of a podcast I had downloaded for a while now that I was, hey, I should go back and listen to this stuff finally. And it was when William Regal had a podcast. I think it's called Wrestling Friends or Wrestling with Friends now with Matt Kuhn. But at the time, it was called Gentleman Villain, and it was William Regal's podcast. So I was listening to this, and Regal mentioned Hogan at one point, and in my head, I immediately went to, I wonder if those two ever faced each other. Well, sure enough, they do have a history, and it ended up being an interesting, little blip of a journey, and that is what we're going to be talking about. William Regal versus Hulk Hogan. And the reason it's a segment and not just a random match review. I was about to say stupid match review. Stupid question. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, you wouldn't start doing stupid matches. There's all those out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of so this segment or the parts of it took place on April 29th, 2002. So this did not occur in WCW when the two would have crossed paths. This occurred during Hogan's, second coming in the WWE. This is when he returned to the red and yellow. He was the undisputed champion at this time. If people recall, he had defeated Triple H at Backlash. With the help of The Undertaker. And so this is leading into the match at Judgment Day, I believe, between Hogan and The Undertaker. So, Leonard, before I sent this to you, when I sent it to you, did you remember any of it?
No. So first of all, you mentioned this to me. My immediate guess was that this was like a random episode of WCW Saturday Night from like 94, 95. And you said, no, it was like Raw from 02. And I did not remember this at all. Was I watching the project at the time? Yes. Did I care that much about it? No. I had actually kind of forgot that Hogan had won the belt again at this point. When he comes out with the belt, I was like, oh yeah, that's right. He did win the title for a brief period during this period.
Yeah.
Oh no, I was very surprised by this, and I know we're going to get to it, but I will just say that I was kind of disappointed with the outcome, but no, I had no memory of this having happened.
Yeah, so if people remember the Undisputed Champion era, in my opinion, I viewed it as, and I was watching very avidly at this time, I was, in college, but it was the fact that Hogan was back, and they had Lesnar, and it felt like this was the most stacked the roster could be at the time. So the fact that Hogan was back and he was like being pushed as a main event guy, and by the way, Vince didn't really have a choice in the matter. Like, if this was during the era that Hogan would come out and get like ovations through a commercial break. So like, he was hot at this time. The crowd wanted him to return to the red and yellow, and that's what happened. But I viewed the Undisputed Championship era as basically hot potato with the title, because it felt like every pay-per-view somebody new was champion. To me, I viewed it as like they're trying to make as many stars the undisputed champion as they can before they split the titles back, just so that they can say, you know, The Rock was the undisputed champion and The Undertaker and Hogan and Lesnar. And, you know, it felt like they were trying to make as many people champion as they could during this time. But yeah, so I was surprised that this was from a Raw in 2002. But what prefaced the match was a promo from William Regal, which is fantastic. It really is. And it makes what they do in the ring that much more disappointing. Basically, he's surrounded with Hulk Hogan memorabilia. He has an episode of Rockin' Wrestling, the cartoon show, playing as it starts. And he basically does a great Regal promo about how he doesn't understand the obsession with Hulk Hogan. And it is very British and very hilarious, but it's also a good serious promo when he wants it to be as well. It just shows how good Regal is on the mic, so to speak. So
Leonard, my favorite line is, why would you worship a man who prances around like a 50 pence tart and feather boas? That's the best line. And you're right. It walks a nice line between humor and being serious. And I kind of wondered how much of it that Regal believed. Like, how much of that is a shoot brother, the way he felt about Hogan.
Yeah.
But it was definitely, when I watched the segment first, I wanted to see the match. Like, yeah. I was like, and the fact that Regal mentioned we'd never been in the ring before. I mean, they played everything up, I think, right, to make someone, I don't know if it was in retrospect now looking back, but I think even at the time, I think the average fan would want to see Regal get his ass kicked. So yeah. I think this was a great way to build to the match.
Right, exactly. It was a great way to build to the match. And up until they actually engaged in physicality, I was like more and more excited about it, because in my head I was like, you know, one of the best chain wrestlers that there was, you know, he doesn't wrestle anymore, is William Regal. And I was like, but Hogan in Japan did chain wrestling, like, yeah. So he can do it. So in my head I was like, wouldn't it be fantastic to see Regal try to do those things to him, and then Hogan kind of out of the blue do some of that stuff back to him. To me, like, they would have more chemistry than I think people would give it credit for.
Yes. You know, Hogan in 02 was past his prime.
Very much.
He wasn't decrepit yet. Like, he was in TNA. Regal, I mean, he had so many renaissances in his career where he would go up and down. I think 02 was when he was on the way up again. And, you know, I've mentioned I'm doing this long-term, like, fantasy wrestling league, and I have Hogan. And anytime I've got Hogan in there with like a technical wrestler, I have him bust out the Japanese stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I have him do an enzugiri and, you know, like a belly to belly. And I have him bust out some crazy stuff when he's in there with like an early Jericho. I did a Jericho Hogan match where he busts out the Japanese stuff. So awesome. I don't think he would have here, but good Lord, would the fans have gone just crazy.
Absolutely. And by the way, we're adding decrepit era Hogan to our fever dreams list for sure.
Please, please, please do. I think that's TNA era Hogan is probably decrepit era.
So the stuff in the ring starts out with Regal inviting him to ringside to have a cup of tea, which is fantastic. Like, so everything we've seen so far is amazing. And you think,
and they both sell it way that Regal invites him down, and Hogan's like, you know, what is going on here? But then he does it because he kind of wants to see where it's going.
Yeah,
they both sell it great.
No one, and no one like plays to the crowd like Hogan would do. So it's all very funny. And then Hogan out of nowhere attacks him, and they do a lot of stuff around the ring. But then the match abruptly comes to a halt because the Undertaker comes down and interferes, because that's the main event of the pay-per-view coming up. And so there really isn't a match at all. And I was so disappointed, which is why initially this was going to be a random match review.
Yeah, and we thought it was a match.
It turned into a segment surgery because I thought it'd be fun to talk about. And but I was so disappointed because I was like, why would you have this promo and all this buildup just to have them not do anything at all? And like, this is what WWE did and still does that drives me insane. Mm-hmm. They will promise you the moon and then they will not deliver in any way. And people were just like, oh, well. And I like, this is one of those situations where it was like, you know, this could have been, even if it was a 5 minute match, they could have done a lot with 5 minutes.
Yeah. I think you made, you know, you make this the main event. I don't know if it was, make it the main event, make it for the title, hype it the whole show, give it 10 minutes altogether, you know, so 3-4 minutes for the entrances, you know, maybe you get 5 to 7 minutes for the match and just let it breathe on its own. And I guarantee you that even if it wasn't a great match, people would have remembered it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what we got here, I did think the brawling around ringside was fun. This is definitely an example of Hogan as the babyface doing heel stuff, because he's the one that throws the tee at Regal and upends the table. Regal did nothing.
Yeah.
And then they're in the ring for, I don't know, like a couple seconds, and then the Undertaker jumps Hogan. And I totally tuned out after about 30 seconds of the beatdown.
Yeah.
I was kind of putting down my final thoughts, and I was like, this is still going on. And it was just a boring, boring beatdown. It was not good. You would think Undertaker beating down Hogan. Okay, that's all right. But it wasn't. This was so much nothing after the T-spot that it angered me.
Yeah, and you know, like looking back at this, the pay-per-view Backlash to Judgment Day, like it really, like when you look at it and you watch the main event of that one and the main event of Judgment Day and all this, it really makes Hogan look weak, because Undertaker, the only reason Hogan won the title against Triple H was because Undertaker interfered, and Undertaker walked away smirking and smiling because he would rather face Hogan than he would Triple H. That was the point of that. And then, of course, at the next pay-per-view, the Undertaker beats Hogan.
Yeah, so he was right.
Yeah, so it was like basically just, it was the most obvious transition champion storyline without actually saying it. but hey, Hogan was champ in 2002, so the fact that that happened at all is kind of crazy. But yeah, I mean, this was an interesting time frame for WWE, and it's a fun era for me to look back on. You know, because I was having a lot of fun watching, because they had a lot of up and coming stars and they had a lot of older guys as well. And so there was like a nice mix, I think, at this time. And you're right about the Undertaker beatdown. You know, there's blood involved, and it was just kind of, you know, it was what it was. But yeah, so we almost got a good Regal versus Hogan match. It would have been cool to see it happen, but we will not see it because both are not wrestling any longer. So
I don't think we'd want to see it right now today in 2024 anyway.
No, definitely not, with one guy who has a you know, crippled, not crippled, but a bad neck, and the other guy that has, I don't know, 12, 13 back surgeries at this point. So
yeah.
But this was a fun little jaunt down memory lane, and so let us know if you remember it. Share your thoughts about it, and please hit the like button and subscribe to our content. Every little bit helps. How's it going, everybody? This is the Nitty Gritty. My name is Chad. With me, as usual, is Leonard, and we are going to be bringing you another edition of our random match reviews, and we're going to be tackling the WCW MTV Snow Brawl, and Leonard is going to give us some background on that before we give our thoughts.
Yes, and it's more than the match, it's the whole thing, and it's one of my favorite bad WCW things ever, considering there's a lot to choose from there. So the WCW Snow Brawl aired on MTV in January of 1999, part of its Snowed In event, which is like its winter version of Spring Break. And this was actually followed a couple months later by Beach Brawl for their Spring Break event that they do.
Yeah, we got to do that too.
Yeah, and a video on YouTube without commercials is about 20 minutes. It comes from the Snow Summit Mountain Resort at Big Bear Lake, California. The ring is outside and under a pavilion with fans on bleachers. We start out with only three Nitro girls dancing in the ring. On commentary, we have Jimmy Hart, Larry Zbysko, and Rob Zombie. And I think that right there tells you how completely random and limited this is with its personnel. Stuttering John from the Howard Stern Show is the ring announcer, and he just has terrible jokes as he introduces the guys for the seven-man battle royal. So before we get there, Chad, any thoughts on the setup and the personnel and just the intro to this thing?
Yeah, so I will say I didn't watch this live, and I knew that this existed. I don't know if Leonard and I had talked about it before, if I talked about it with somebody else, but I knew it existed. I didn't watch the thing the whole way through. I'll give credit to Rob Zombie. He tries. He's obviously there as the music personality, and clearly doesn't know a ton about wrestling, but he does try. He doesn't talk down on anything. He tries to make jokes and be a colorful commentator in that way. Yeah, Stuttering John is terrible. That was a bad idea. They play Offspring Pretty Fly for a White Guy because we're on MTV, so we're not just limited to the Turner music catalog, such as it was. So you have a lot of different songs playing. You have Backstreet Boys at one point, and then during the match, music just plays, and it's really, really not a good mesh when the match starts. Like, just, and we'll get more into that when we talk about the match. But yeah, this is very random. Like Leonard said, Snowed In was a winter's themed program on MTV that was kind of like their spring break. They would do it in 2000 and 2001 as well, and it didn't really get the popularity I think that they were hoping it would. They only did it those few years. There was no real snow at this time. I looked this up.
Oh.
So
It
it's
didn't seem as cold to me as you would have thought it would be for snow. I will say that.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at some of the wrestlers are, getting sweaty as they wrestle, but like they're coming in there, they're wearing regular wrestling gear. So, I don't think that they were dying in terms of temperature.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was something. So let's get to the match then.
Sure. So the wrestlers involved here is Conan, who rides in on a snowmobile, Kenny Chaos, Disco Inferno, Billy Kidman, Bryan Adams, Wrath, who's also Brian Clark, and Booker T. Some of the guys cut promos, and I'm going to be honest, this may be the best Bryan Adams promo I've ever heard. And I got to ask, they couldn't find three more guys for an even 10.
It's very random.
Yeah, again, the names are random. They're random mid-carders. If you just like threw in people's natural tag partner, you could get to 10. And where's Glacier? He would have been perfect for this.
You would think, this strikes me as a collaboration that they were really excited about in theory. And then it's like, oh shit, we need to actually do this. Find some guys that want to go and are willing to go. And here's the guys that are willing to go. And it's these seven random guys. There's no really sense of a theme or anything like that. You mentioned Glacier. It's just kind of whatever guys are not doing anything else.
Yeah. So we take a break. After the break, one of the Nitro girls, I think it's Whisper, gives Zombie something to eat. He doesn't know what it is. And Jimmy Hart says never to trust a woman, which I just thought was funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, Zombie then fires a gun to start the match. It's a pretty standard brawling for a battle royal. Elimination's in order. We have Wrath, Kenny Chaos, Conan, Billy Kidman, Booker T. And then Adams turns on Disco Inferno and tosses him. Disco was representing the Wolfpack and Adams the NWO Black and White. Just about everyone kind of gets their sort of signature stuff in. This was way longer than I would have guessed. I thought it would be pretty quick eliminations. Not really a whole lot to talk about with the match itself. Like I said, very standard battle royal. I wouldn't want to give it, say, like 0 stars, but it's like a half star match.
Yeah, I would concur with the either 0 or half stars there. This, you know, you say a standard battle royal. I guess it is in terms of it's a battle royal and the rules are the same. But this was lame, this battle royal. And if you wanted to see why these wrestlers were not top tier talent, then just watch this because they don't give a shit.
Right. Nope. Yeah. No one brings it.
Like they're just going, literally going through the motions about as lame as they possibly can. Like the commentary focuses on Disco Inferno a lot because of the music of the era was obviously not disco and, you know, his hair. And, you know, it's just, this was, like you said, altogether, this is like 19 minutes and change if you look it up on YouTube. And it is extremely boring. And I think boring for everyone involved except the crowd, who were like literally on fire, not for the match, I think, just maybe excited to be there.
Yeah, and there's probably some alcohol and maybe some other herbal remedies involved too, I would guess.
Yeah, yeah, that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, but so post-match, you know, Brian Adams won, and I read a review that's guessed that he won because he has the same name as a rock star. So too bad Sting wasn't there. You know, I would have guessed Kidman or Booker T would have won because they're the most over faces. And like I said before, I wasn't kidding when I said that was Brian Adams' like best promo. This is probably the biggest win of his career, a singles win. And he wins a giant snowflake trophy.
Which I want to know where that is.
Like, okay, I have some info on that. So Adams thanks all the little people, which is most of the crowd. He thanks himself for looking so good. Then he gets jumped by Conan from behind in a yellow jacket. And he tells Adams to, quote, bow down, toss his salad, and peel his potatoes.
Yeah, which...
Don't know what any of that means, except for one.
Right, well, yeah.
Yeah, and then Conan steals the trophy. So first time I think a trophy has not been destroyed in wrestling. It was actually taken. So I found a podcast of Disco Inferno and Conan talking about it. Someone had wrote them a question and asking about it. And Disco said it was cold. Conan said if he has the trophy still, he has no idea where it went. He does not remember winning it. And of course, he didn't win it. He stole it. So he didn't remember that. So I think that should tell you, you know, what you need to know about the talent involved, like we were talking about, because Disco Inferno and Conan barely remember having been involved. So if that trophy is anywhere, it's in the back of Conan's closet somewhere and he forgot about it.
Well, okay. So let's touch on that then also. So anybody who watches the Most Wanted Treasures show on A&E that WWE is doing knows that most wrestlers were not good about what they did with their stuff, whether it be their tights or any sort of thing that went with their character. They were not good about keeping it. Some of them were. Undertaker is one that comes to mind, kept his stuff very organized, but most of them were not. So if you're looking at people like top guys that are not good at it, if you're then going to rope in Brian Adams and Conan and say, where's this snowflake trophy? It does not shock me that nobody knows where it is. And that would be a great Most Wanted Treasures episode, like an episode all about the most random crap that you can find, like Hogan's fist helmet and like all that stuff. Do an episode of all these random things. And I would love to see that. But no, instead they did an hour on The Miz, which... Come on. Anyway, back on track. I would love to have that trophy. I don't know how much I'd pay for it, but I think it would be fun to have. And like Conan coming out at the end is just ridiculous. He was eliminated and then he came out, and like, you know, I'd be lying if I said I watched Nitro every week, but I would be shocked if this battle royal had any bearing on anything that was happening in the main storylines. And
oh, no.
Why they wouldn't try to connect you with something going on Nitro or Thunder is head scratching. Like, this is a perfect opportunity to bring more fans into your product. That, you know, if I was working there, honestly, I'm not a business expert, but I would say, okay, we're going to have a lot of eyes on our product that are not normally on our product. How can we make them tune in to our regular product every Monday or whatever it was? And they just didn't care about that factor. And that's the most disappointing thing to this, other than just the fact that it was dull, is the fact that they just didn't seem to think, well, you know, how can we get more viewers?
Yeah, I mean, and WCW was always kind of like that with their crossover stuff. I mean, on the day that we're recording this, Wrestling Bios, which we've talked about, I'm a fan of, released a video about the Baywatch episode of WCW, where Hogan and Savage and Flair are all on it, and how they're playing like weird versions of themselves.
Yeah.
Like Ric Flair is a real estate magnate who buys a kids center that Hulk Hogan went to when he was a child. I mean, it's just WCW was always a lot worse than WWE where it came to like crossovers and making it work for them and making it kind of make sense within context. You know, and to go to your point, the only thing I think they do here that ties into regular continuity would be they do talk a little bit about how Disco's in the Wolfpack and how Bryan Adams is in the Black and White, and how there is kind of a connection there, but there's also kind of an animosity there too. And this was right around that time where the Wolfpack was sort of its own deal and the B team was very much the B team. And again, you know, I mentioned Wrestling Bios. He does the Reliving the War, where every week he compares Raw and Nitro. And he's into this, I believe, the summer of 99 right now. So just past this time period and just past the period where the NWO kind of officially broke up. It's around the time where Hogan went back to the red and yellow is where he's at. So, yeah, it's again, like I said, it's one of those things that is so bad that I enjoy the badness of it and just the randomness of it. The fact that you could only get three Nitro girls, like you couldn't even send all six of these random dancers.
Right. Some of them were like, no, I'm not going.
Yeah, that's what it was, you know? I mean, think about what this could have been if you would have had, say, all the Nitro girls, if you would have had, you know, like, Shivani and Zabisco, if you would have had, you know, at least like Sting or Flair or Nash or at least one or two of the main event guys.
Yeah.
Or if you would have done this, say, Battle Royal, and then even say, you know, Billy Kidman's there, Cruiserweight champion, do a Cruiserweight match because those were always great for WCW.
Right. Yeah, that's what it needed to be a more thought out plan with something to tie into the regular show. And like you said, like you have Bryan Adams winning and he has this big turn on Disco, but in, you know, he comes out and he does a heel promo and then they're making it seem like the NWO is just this one big happy family, which anybody who tunes into the show knows that that's not true. Mm-hmm. And he does this big turn, which he's a heel. So he's a heel turning on a heel. Well, yeah. I like you think that it's fun to look at the badness and the randomness of it as well. And it took me like a few minutes to try and have memories flood back in of Snowed in general and some of the things that were on it at the time.
Yeah, I wasn't really watching MTV at this time, but I actually do remember watching this. I don't know if it was a replay or live, and it was still an era where you would just flip through channels until you found something. And I think that's just kind of how I happened upon it.
Yeah. Like, see, I would be, if you know, you're at a ski resort, I'd be making like the match go and use every part of that ski resort. You know, like they end with throwing Disco into the snowbank.
Yeah.
Like, could have done more of that. Like, have like a hardcore match that goes all over the ski resort. That would be fun. Anyway.
Yeah. Like, what was that? It was the episode of Shotgun Saturday Night where they were like at the mall. It was in the subway terminal, right? Yeah, and they like were fighting on the escalator and stuff. Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you're in a unique space, use the space.
Absolutely. Well, I'm sure we will review Beach Brawl at some point too. And I've always heard of Snow Brawl, but until I did research for this, I didn't even know that Beach Brawl was a thing. So I'm anxious to see what happens on that one. And let us know what you think. If you have memories of this, if you watched it live, let me and Leonard know what you think in the comments section. Hit the like button and subscribe to our content. And check out our other videos, Segment Surgery, What's That Card, our full-length episodes. We're also available wherever you listen to podcasts. For Leonard, my name is Chad, and we will see you next time. How's it going, everybody? This is the Nitty Gritty. My name is Chad. With me, as usual, is Leonard. This is a show about wrestling, and we are going to be bringing you another edition of our random match reviews. And we are going to be reviewing a very random match, and that would be from May 13th, 1984, Rick Martel versus Jumbo Tsuruta for the AWA Championship. And first, let's me talk about why this match came on my radar. So I recently read/listened to the audiobook for Death of the Territories. And it was a good book. The author's name escapes me. But it was a good book, but it read like an encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm.
Very little commentary on things. It was basically just listing everything that happened, talking a little bit about who the people were. It was a very factually based book. So if you're not into wrestling in a hardcore way, you will not enjoy it. But if you love the history of wrestling, I do recommend it.
Tim Hornibaker.
I knew it was Tim something. Thank
you. Yeah, I don't think I've ever read any of his stuff, but I do know that he is a wrestling historian, and that he's been on Jim Cornette's podcast a couple times talking about some of his work. So I am familiar with him.
That makes sense. And the guy who read the audiobook, I joked with a friend, was clearly not somebody that knew a ton about wrestling, because he pronounced things like he pronounced the event Starcade as Starcade. That was funny. Anyway, they mention this match as, you know, just a part of the regular timeline of events with AWA. And I thought to myself, wow, what a random pairing of people. And I didn't know like what had happened in this match, and you know, spoiler alert, but Rick Martel wins this match, and it starts a very long title reign for him. And I didn't realize that he was AWA champ and had such a long reign. And I certainly know who Jumbo Tsuruta is as well. Like, if you look up greatest matches of the 80s, you'll see a lot of the matches that we all know and love. But if you want to look, if the Japan stuff comes up, chances are this guy is a part of that match, because he was in so many. He was in All Japan Pro Wrestling and was the first ever Triple Crown winner there. So he is very much a legend, but perhaps a legend that some people don't know about anymore.
As we talk, I've never been big in Japanese wrestling. I know the name. I don't know a lot about him. As far as Rick Martel goes, yeah, I was aware that he was the AWA champ for a decent period for the time period. And Kurt Hennig was too. You know, sometimes when people say, oh, the best people who never held a world title, and Hennig's name may come up and Martel's name may came up, but go, well, they were AWA world champions, and that was considered a world title when they held it. If you would ask me anything about Martel's reign, I couldn't tell you that. I think it largely was underwhelming. I don't think it moved the needle for them too much. It kind of felt like Vern doing a Bob Backlund thing. We need to go younger, but I still want a guy that can work. Nothing against Rick Martel, but if you definitely, you look at him here and say who he would become later as the model, the charisma level, the promo level is way different.
Oh yeah. No, absolutely. I agree. So I want to say that this reign lasted almost 19 months. It was the third longest title reign and the longest title reign of the, I guess, of the 80s, maybe for AWA.
Probably. Who did he lose to? Was it Hansen?
Yes, he did. He lost to Stan Hansen in 1985. Yep. He had matches with Ric Flair, Jimmy Garvin, Nick Bockwinkel, and King Tonga. Rick Martel's finishing move at the time kind of alternated between a slingshot splash, a combination of an atomic drop, and a back suplex. And so this video is about, 27, 29 minutes, depending on where you find it. You can find it a couple different places. But before I get to the match itself, the video I sent you, Leonard, I certainly didn't realize it when I sent it, like that it would have both Japanese and English commentary.
It alternates throughout. We start with the, I think, with the American, and it goes to the Japanese, and then about 10 minutes in, it shifts back.
Yeah, which
and
is
then at the end, it shifts back again. So it was kind of jarring in that way. Although I think I preferred the Japanese commentary, which I couldn't understand. I did not look up the announcer for the AWA. I think it was, Mel something at the time, but he was not good. He called everything a body slam. He called a flying crossbody a body slam.
Yeah.
He didn't know what a hot shot was.
Right.
Yeah. Which would have been a hot shot at the time because of Eddie Gilbert. It wasn't a stun gun yet. And I don't know if it was Mel. I can't remember his last name. So I didn't look it up who the announcer was, but the AWA announcer was not good.
No, I agree. I agree with you. And you know, it is worth mentioning on a side tangent, like if you watch some of the Japanese matches, specifically the older ones, because now you can kind of rely on them having an English commentary team. But certainly back in the 90s and the early aughts, they didn't always have that. But they were always very expressive. So if you watch some of the matches and you don't understand what they're saying, it's not really as big of a deal as you might think, you know, because some of them are very good at what they do. But let's get into the match itself. I'm just kind of go over bullet points. There's a lot of chain wrestling to start.
Yeah.
And then you have Jumbo Tsuruta getting Rick Martel into, ironically, a Boston Crab. And you then have Martel doing a double arm hook. I think it was Martel. Yeah, he does a cross body. Tsuruta does a cool arm drag. Martel has a very long period where he gets him into a headlock. Tsuruta does a pile driver and a flying knee. There's an abdominal stretch, which I think he was pretty famous for at the time. And there's a slam and a backbreaker by Tsuruta, I believe. And a suplex. And then towards the end of the match, there's a drop kick into the referee. Martel does the, which wasn't called that at the time, but a stun gun
in
crossbody. And, you know, this match, like, apparently, like, so I know that they've done a lot of other matches. You can, when you Google their names on YouTube or, you know, whatever, you will see that there's multiple matches. And I haven't watched them all, but I would probably guess that this is not the best one that they did. I'll bet you they got into a better chemistry.
Yeah.
You know, this match, you know, has, I don't want to, it kind of has spots rather than a continuous narrative. Go ahead.
I was gonna agree with you there. So, you know, I, as watching this, I really liked the start of it. I thought I liked the intensity and the pacing at the start, the focus on the grappling. I loved, my favorite spot, the entire thing, believe it or not, was early on. Tsuruta has this sort of leg lock on Martel, and Martel breaks it by grabbing his ankle and just pushing him away so he loses his footing. So then Jumbo just reverses. So since he's facing away, now Martel can't reach his ankle. I mean, that's just brilliant. I just love that. And I think the story early on was Jumbo trying to throw every submission that he had at Martel, and Martel just being very tenacious. And this felt very much like Martel wrestling Tsuruta's match. It felt old school to me. It felt Japanese to me. It was just a lot of grappling with a couple high spots in there. The crowd wavered throughout. Like, they popped for Martel. They popped for the high spots, but they didn't pop for a whole lot of anything else.
Yeah.
And it does pick up a little bit at the end where Martel starts to work in some different moves. The near finishes towards the end, I thought was really solid, but the finish with the flying crossbody just felt kind of lackluster to me. You know, I agree with you that they probably maybe would have done better with better chemistry, you know, in future matches. It felt to me like it was just, it didn't reach another gear. It was very much kind of at this second gear serviceable match to have a serviceable match. Yeah. You know, I would give it maybe 3 stars because of the technical aspects of it, and that might be a little bit generous on my part. I can't say that it's a bad match. I just don't feel it was a very interesting match.
I see where you're coming from there. I too like the beginning and the end. You know, there's some lull there with the headlock. I did like that the psychology, if there was any, was Martel using Saruta's size and strength against him.
Yes.
You know, which I thought was good. And you're right in that I think that they were wrestling Saruta's match here. But it should be worth noting this was a face versus face match, but Saruta was doing heelish things because he knew it would be a pro Martel crowd.
Yeah, being in Minnesota, being in AWA's backyard.
Yeah. Right. And so, yeah, I might go a little bit more, like I might go 3.25 on this one. I probably will go and check out one of their other ones just to see how it had stacks up against this. But of course, I should add that they show Vern in the front row, and
yes,
like, he looks to be, you know, animated about the whole thing, which is interesting.
They did try to put it over as being epic. Like, not only is Vern there, but I think Gene Kaninsky might be there, or a few other like old legend dudes.
And it's you know, AWA at this time obviously was not doing very well, and they would continue to obviously not do well.
This was after Hogan left, so you know, this was 84.
And in my opinion, even when they had Hogan, and well beyond that, one of my biggest issues with AWA is not necessarily the quality of some of their matches. They relied on Nick Bockwinkel too much, to the point where politics got involved with Hogan specifically, and others, where it's like Bockwinkel was always a part of it. And like, they, by the time they started pushing guys like Martel and Kurt Hennig, Vince was already expanding everywhere, and Georgia and that territory was the distant second. So, you know, things were already happening. Like,
Who did Vince steal? He steals Martel, and he steals Hennig, and he steals the Rockers, and he basically steals every dude they had under the age of 30.
Yeah, which, tying back to the book I read, is obviously a big part of that book.
So, yeah. I think the biggest thing that Vince did, aside from, you know, like the national expansion itself, was he just took the talent of everybody else. If you don't have talent, you don't have a product. And if you don't have young talent, then you're relying on these guys past their prime, or you're relying on guys who are maybe still green.
Right.
So, you know, everybody who's in that sweet spot of like their prime, that's who Vince was wooing with more money, or against maybe someone like the Junkyard Dog, who had personal problems, which we're not going to get into, down in Mid-South. But when he took Dog was the biggest draw Mid-South ever had.
Yeah. And, you know, looking at the book, and like, you know, AWA trying to push a younger star, he was young at the time, like Martel, you know, Vince was just very tenacious in his expansion of the WWF. Like, he would go into these territories and he would try to steal the prime TV slots, and he would pay them to get the time, and sometimes that would go his way, and other times it might not, and he might not draw as much as the territory that had been there right away, but he kept going back and kept chopping away at each of these territories until he had them. And it was just kind of like looking at the full aspect of the business as you try to expand rather than what's our next show going to be. Like he was looking at marketing and big events and collaborations with MTV and all that stuff. Whereas AWA, I think, wanted things to a degree to kind of stay the same. Like, we want this territory and we don't want anybody in it. And it's like the world is moving on.
Yeah. And when they attempted to, you know, kind of match what WWE was doing, like, you know, their ESPN show, not nearly the production value, not nearly the, you know, the talent and the matches. When they finally did a pay-per-view, you know, the Wrestle Rock Rumble, I think was maybe their, or Clash might, or a Super Clash might have been it. But anyway, when they did their first pay-per-view, again, no idea what they were doing. I think it might have been Super Clash, where if you watch it, there's like 100 people there. Like, it's like totally blacked out after the, like, the fifth row of seats.
Yeah.
So it was them trying to getting into the game too late. They did too little too late. And I think, and again, to mention Mid-South, I think they try to do the same thing again, maybe too little too late there. So
no, I agree. And so we're not too far off on our opinions of this match. It was a fun watch. I've always meant to go watching more Jumbo Tsuruta matches. But when I saw this one, I thought it would be a good place to, you know, maybe dive further into his career.
You know, I told you I do this long-term booking fed, and there's a guy who joined not too long ago who's doing like a super Japanese fed. And he has like Tsuruta and Choshu and, you know, Giant Baba and all these guys, right, and Misawa. And like, I'm, you know, I try to read everyone else's stuff. So I'm actually getting my first kind of real exposure to some of these guys based on how he's right, how he's writing them. And, you know, and I wouldn't be against, you know, checking out some Japanese stuff. I actually had someone years ago, and I don't remember who it was, in some message board, sent me like VHS tapes of like some Japanese stuff. And a lot of it was them versus, you know, American wrestlers, because he thought that would get me into it. You know, it was like, hey, if it's, you know, Stan Hansen worked a lot, Bruiser Brody worked a lot over in Japan. You know, guys like that. I know we talked about Furnace and LaFon in Japan and the matches they would have over there at one time. So, yeah, so I actually enjoyed this.
Powers, one of our favorite tag teams.
Yeah, it's one of our favorite tag teams. So I actually enjoyed this to see Tsuruta, who, again, is a guy that I have in the past couple of weeks been reading this guy's interpretation of Tsuruta. So to see him and to see that, I thought was interesting. And I would be interested in going back and watching some more Martel stuff, like some stuff from the AWA. I know there's AWA on the network, or Peacock, which I still call the network. I don't know how much is on there. I really haven't delved into it. Actually, as a side note, I'm currently watching like ECW TV.
Okay.
Which from the start, which goes back to like 93. So this is Eastern Championship Wrestling, where Jimmy Snuka's the champ and Eddie Gilbert's there. And like, so it's like Eddie Gilbert and Don Morocco and Jimmy Snuka. And then it's like Tommy Cairo and Tony Stetson and Larry Sween. and it's really kind of an odd juxtaposition of talent that they have. But the reason I'm doing that is because in this other wrestling, fantasy wrestling draft I'm doing right now, Ronnie, good friend of the show, gave me the idea of kind of doing a combination of ECW and today. Like, what if Paul Heyman had a time machine and could, like, say, grab CM Punk and Gunther and maybe some guys that he, you know, would like, and send them back to 95?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly those two names would probably be on his list.
Yeah, yeah. So that's that kind of how I've been drafting. I'll have to show you. I'll send you a link to it. I'll show you once I get everything put together. But we're off on a total tangent now. Anyway, Rick Martel, Jumbo Tsuruta, go watch it.
Right. Yeah. Let us know if you remember this match and you watched it back then. Let us know if you have seen it. Let us know in the comments. Hit the like button, subscribe to our content, check out our other episodes, Segment Surgery, What's That Card, Stupid Questions, and our full length episodes. We are also available wherever you listen to podcasts. So please give us some love on wherever you choose to check us out. And thank you very much for tuning in. For Leonard, my name is Chad, and we will see you next time.